This man, and I'm sorry, Dominique, but I'm not allowed to tell you his name, prefers to travel on a French passport. You will be posing as lovers, a successful businessman and his younger girlfriend. We would use a Palestinian woman if we could. Unfortunately, a European woman is required.
We, Youssef? What do you mean by we? I thought you were a student. I thought you were a waiter, for God's sake. When did we become involved with a man who has to travel under an assumed name to a meeting that will change the course of history in the Middle East? So much for complete honesty, eh, Youssef?
I've made no secret of my political beliefs. I've made no secret of my opposition to the peace process.
Yes, but you did make a secret of the fact that you were involved with people like this. So where is he going? How would it work?
You'll fly to Paris, to Charles de Gaulle Airport. You'll meet the Palestinian leader in the terminal. Only he and a few of his closest aides know where he's going. You'll accompany him to the gate and board the airplane. The destination may be the site of the meeting, or you may have to take another flight, or a train, or a ferry, or drive, I don't know. When the meeting is over, you'll return to Paris and go your separate ways. You'll never see him again, and you'll never mention this to another person.
How long?
You should plan for a week, but expect less.
I need to think about it.
Of course you need to think about it. But while you're making your decision, it is critical that you not discuss this with anyone.
I understand, I suppose. When do you need an answer?
Tomorrow night. When the tape ended, Shamron looked up.
Why so glum, Gabriel? Why aren't you jumping for joy?
Because it sounds too good to be true. You're not going to start this again, are you, Gabriel?
If they thought she was working for us, she'd already be dead, and Youssef would be going to ground. No, Gabriel, this is one that we go with.
But Jacqueline isn't a professional. She's a model, Ari. And Tariq makes a habit of executing the women he uses for cover. That young American girl, the Dutch girl in Amsterdam.
Don't worry so much, Gabriel. Jacqueline can look after herself. And besides, we'll be with her every step of the way.
We will? We let her get onto a plane at Charles de Gaulle without even knowing where the plane is going? We'll be playing catch-up from the moment the game begins.
We'll know where they're going the moment they go to the gate. And we'll be watching them the moment they step off the plane at the other end. She won't be out of our sight for a minute.
And then?
When the moment presents itself, you'll take Tariq down. Then it will be over.
St. James's, London. At 3 in the afternoon, Julian Isherwood sat with his left hand on a warm mug of tea, his right on a stack of the bills he could not pay. He treated himself to the luxury of a glance at the creature in his anteroom. A striking figure, this girl who called herself Dominique. A real work of art. In his copious spare time, Isherwood had concocted all sorts of fantasies about this girl. Sometimes he wondered whether she was French at all, or just one of those Israelis who could pass herself off as almost anything. His reverie ended when he heard 2 short bursts of an automotive horn. From his window, he saw a delivery van standing just outside the sealed doors of the loading bay. Funny. There were no deliveries scheduled for today. The driver honked again, long and loud this time.
For Christ's sake, Isherwood thought. Who the hell are you? What do you want?
Then he peered down through the front windshield. Because of the angle, he could not see the driver's face. He could only see a pair of hands wrapped around the steering wheel. He would have recognized those hands anywhere. Best hands in the business. They rode the lift to the upper gallery, Jacqueline between them like a prisoner, Gabrielle to her left, Shamron to her right. She tried to catch Gabrielle's eye, but he was looking straight ahead. When the door opened, Shamron guided her to the viewing bench, as though he were placing a witness in the dark. She sat with her legs crossed at the ankles, elbows resting on her knees, her chin resting on her hands. Gabriel stood behind her. Shamron paced the length of the gallery like a prospective buyer unimpressed with the merchandise. He spoke for 20 minutes without pausing. As Jacqueline watched him, she thought about the night he asked her to join the office. She felt the same sense of purpose and duty she had felt that night. Shamron's taut little body portrayed so much strength that her fears seemed to melt away. On its face, what he was asking of her was outrageous, accompany the world's most dangerous terrorist on a mission. But she was able to evaluate his words without the cumbersome emotion of fear. She thought, Shamron is not afraid, therefore I am not afraid. She had to admit that she was enthralled by the mere idea of it. Imagine, the girl from Marseille, whose grandparents were murdered in the Holocaust, helping to destroy Tariq al-Hurani and preserve the security of Israel. It would be the perfect end to her career with the office, the fulfillment of every desire that made her join in the first place. It would also prove to Gabrielle that she could be brave too.
You have every right to tell us no, Shamron said. You signed up for a very different operation than this, one much shorter in duration and with considerably less physical risk. But the situation has changed. Sometimes operations are like that.
He stopped pacing and stood directly in front of her.
But I can assure you of one thing, Jacqueline. Your safety will be our first priority. You'll never be alone. We'll walk you to the airplane and be waiting at the other end when you come off. We'll go wherever you go. And the first time an opportunity presents itself, we'll move in and end things. You also have my word that if your life is in danger, we will move in at that moment, regardless of the consequences. Do you understand what I'm saying to you?
She nodded. Shamron reached into his briefcase, withdrew a small gift box, about 2 inches by 2 inches, and handed it to Jacqueline. She opened it, a gold lighter nestled in white cotton filler.
It sends out a beacon with a range of 30 miles, which means if something goes wrong, if we lose contact with you for some reason, we'll always be able to find you again.
Jacqueline removed the lighter from the box and snapped the hammer. The lighter expelled a slender tongue of flame. When she slipped the lighter into the breast pocket of her blouse, Shamron's face broke into a brief smile.
I feel obligated to inform you that your friend Gabriel has serious reservations about this whole thing.
He was on the move again, this time standing before the landscape by Claude.
Gabriel is afraid you might be walking straight into a trap. Usually I trust Gabriel's opinion. We have a considerable history between us. But in this case, I find myself in respectful disagreement with him.
Jacqueline looked at Gabriel then, but he was standing in front of the Del Vaga, craning his neck sideways, as if he was looking for flaws in the last restoration. Don't look at me, he was saying. This is your decision, yours alone. Shamron left them alone. Gabriel crossed the room and stood where Shamron had been. Jacqueline wanted him closer, but Gabriel seemed to require a buffer zone. His face had already changed. It was the same change that had come over him in Tunis. There had been 2 Gabriels in Tunis, the Gabriel of the surveillance phase when they had been lovers, and Gabriel the night of the assassination. She remembered the way he had looked during the drive from the beach to the villa, part grim determination, part dread. He looked the same way now. It was his killing face, she decided. When he spoke, he resumed where Shamron had left off. Your link to the office will be the telephone in your flat here in London. The line will be routed through to headquarters in Tel Aviv on a secure link. When you arrive at your destination, tell Tariq you need to check your messages. When you call, the people in the office will see the number you're dialing from and locate it.
If you're alone, you can even talk to them and pass along messages to us. It will be very secure.
And what if he refuses to let me use the telephone?
Then you throw a fit. You tell him that Yusuf never said you wouldn't be allowed to use the telephone. You tell him Yusuf never said you were going to become a prisoner. Tell him that unless you're allowed to check your messages, you're leaving. Remember, as far as you know, this man is a Palestinian dignitary of some sort. He's on a diplomatic mission. He's not someone you're supposed to fear. If he senses you're afraid of him, he'll suspect you know more than you should know.
I understand.
Don't be surprised if you hear messages on your machine. We'll place a few there. Maybe it will be Julian Isherwood asking when you're planning to return. Maybe it will be a family member or a friend in Paris. Maybe a man calling to ask you to dinner. You're an attractive woman. It would be suspicious if there weren't other men pursuing you. She thought,
so why not you, Gabriel?
Tonight, before you give him your answer, I want you to express serious doubts about the whole thing one more time. To Jacqueline Delacroix, the concept of traveling with a strange man might sound reasonable, but to Dominique Bonnard it sounds like utter lunacy. I want you to quarrel with him. I want you to force him to make assurances about your safety. In the end, of course, you'll agree to go, but not without a fight. And when you do agree, by the way, don't be surprised if he refuses to allow you to leave his presence. Don't be surprised if he moves you to another location for the night. Do you understand all this? Jacqueline nodded slowly, mesmerized by the serene intensity of Gabrielle's voice. I want you to be prepared for how this is going to end. Whether it's someplace quiet, someplace completely out of sight, or in the middle of a busy street. The point I'm trying to make is that you'll never know when it's going to end. If you do happen to see me coming, you're not to look at me. You're not to flinch or call out my name. If you do, we may both end up dead. He paused for a moment, then added, he won't die right away. A .22 caliber Beretta isn't that kind of weapon. It takes several shots in the right place. After I knock him down, I'll have to finish the job. There's only one way to do that. He fashioned his hand into the shape of a pistol and placed his forefinger against the side of her temple. I don't want you to watch me when I do this. It's not who I am. She reached up and took his hand away from the side of her head. She folded his forefinger into his palm so that his hand was no longer shaped like a Beretta. Then, finally, Gabrielle leaned forward and kissed her lips. How is she? Asked Shamron, as Gabrielle turned into Oxford Street and headed east.
She's resolute.
And you?
My feelings are immaterial at this point.
You're not excited in any way? You're not thrilled by the prospect of going into battle? The chase does not make you feel completely alive?
I lost those feelings a long time ago.
You and I are different, Gabrielle. I'm not ashamed to admit it, but I live for this moment. I live for the moment that I can place my foot against the throat of my enemy and crush the wind out of him.
You're right. You and I are very different.
If I didn't know better, I'd say you had feelings for her.
I've always liked her.
You've never liked anyone or anything in your life. You feel love, you feel hate, or you feel nothing at all. There is no middle ground for you.
Gabrielle crossed the Tottenham Court Road and entered Holborn. At New Square, he pulled to the curb. Shamron removed a thin file from his briefcase and held it up for Gabrielle.
This has every known photograph of Tariq. There aren't many, and the ones we do have are dated. Have a look at them anyway. It would be rather embarrassing if we shot the wrong man.
Like Lillehammer, Gabrielle said.
Shamron grimaced at the mere mention of Lillehammer, a Norwegian skiing village and the site of the worst operational fiasco in the history of Israeli intelligence. In July 1973, a pair of Kidons from Shamron's team assassinated a man they believed to be Ali Hassan Salameh, Black September's chief of operations and the mastermind of the Munich massacre. It turned out to be a tragic case of mistaken identity. The man was not Salameh, but a Moroccan waiter who was married to a Norwegian woman. Shamron said, "Please, do you really think now is a good time to mention Lillehammer?" He paused, then smiled with surprising warmth. "I know you think I'm a monster, a man completely without morals. Perhaps you're right. But I always loved you, Gabriel. You were always my favorite. You were my prince of fire. No matter what happens, I want you to remember that. Where are you going, by the way?" "We're going to need an airplane tomorrow. I thought I'd book a reservation on Air Stone." "Ari, you're not drinking. Unfair!" "Sorry, Benjamin, but I have a long night ahead of me. Work?" Shamron inclined his head slightly to indicate the affirmative. "So, what brings you here?"
"I need a favor."
"Course you need a favor. Wouldn't be here otherwise. Hope you haven't come looking for money, because the Bank of Stone is temporarily closed, and your account is badly overdrawn. Besides, money's gone. Creditors are singing a bloody aria. They want what's rightfully theirs. Funny how creditors can be. And as for my lenders, well, let's just say they're heading for calmer waters. What I'm trying to say to you, Ari, my old stick, is that I am in serious fucking financial trouble."
"It's not about money."
"So what is it? Speak, Ari."
"I need to borrow your jet. Actually, I need to borrow you and your jet."
"I'm listening. You have my attention now."
"Tomorrow, an enemy of the State of Israel is going to board a flight at Charles de Gaulle. Unfortunately, we don't know what flight or what his destination is, and we won't know until he gets on the plane. It's imperative that we follow rapidly and that we arrive with some degree of secrecy."
Benjamin Stone cut him short. "This," he said, "sounds exciting." He snatched up the telephone and ordered the plane to be ready in an hour, and a suite for himself that night at the Ritz. When he rang off, he refilled his glass of champagne and raised it in Shamron's direction.
"I can't thank you enough, Benjamin.
You owe me, Ari. Someday I'm going to need a favor. Someday all debts come due." St. James's, London. Jacqueline had hoped a brief walk alone would settle her nerves. It was a mistake. She should have taken a taxi straight to Yusuf's door, because now she felt like turning around and telling Shamron and Gabriel to go to hell. She had just a few seconds to pull herself together. She realized she was not used to fear, at least not the kind of fear that made it nearly impossible to breathe. She had felt fear like this only once in her life, the night of the raid in Tunis. But that night, Gabriel had been at her side. Now she was alone. She thought of her grandparents and the fear they must have felt while they were waiting to die at Sobibor. "If they could face death at the hands of the Nazis, I can face this," she thought. But there was something else she was feeling. Love. Intense, unbearable, intolerable love. Perfect love. Love that had survived 12 years, meaningless relationships with other men. It was the promise of Gabriel that finally pushed her forward toward Yusuf's door. Yet when she pressed the buzzer, Yusuf didn't answer. She pressed it again, still nothing. She looked at her watch. He had told her to come at 9. She was so nervous about arriving late that she had managed to come 5 minutes early. "So what should I do, Gabriel? Stay? Walk around the block?" If she left, she might never come back. She lit a cigarette, stamped her feet against the cold, waited. A moment later, a Ford van braked to a halt in the street in front of her. The side door slid open. Yusuf leapt out. He walked toward her, hands in the pockets of his leather jacket, head swiveling from side to side.
"How long have you been standing here?"
"I don't know. 3 minutes? 5 minutes? Where the hell have you been?"
"I told you to come at 9. I didn't say 5 minutes before 9. I said 9.
"So I was a few minutes early. What's the big deal?"
"Because the rules have changed."
She remembered what Gabriel had said to her. "You have no reason to be afraid. If they push you, push back."
"Listen, the rules haven't changed until I say they've changed. I haven't decided whether I'm going. This is crazy, Yusuf. You won't tell me where I'm going. You won't tell me when I'll be back. I love you, Yusuf. I want to help you. But you have to put yourself in my shoes."
His demeanor softened immediately.
"I'm sorry, Dominique. I'm just a little tense. Everything has to go right. I didn't mean to take it out on you. Come inside, we'll talk. But we don't have much time."
Gabriel had never seen the Ford van till now. He wrote down the registration number as it vanished into the darkness. Shamron joined him in the window. Together they watched Yusuf and Jacqueline disappear into the lobby. A moment later, lights burned in Yusuf's flat. Gabriel could hear two voices, Yusuf, calm and reassuring, Jacqueline, edgy, stressed. Shamron made a base camp at the end of the couch and watched the scene across the street as though it were being played out on a movie screen. Gabriel closed his eyes and listened. They were stalking each other, circling the room like prize fighters. Gabriel didn't have to watch it. He could hear it in the way the audio level rose each time one of them passed by the telephone.
"What is it, Yusuf? Drugs? A bomb? Tell me, you bastard!"
So convincing was her performance that Gabriel feared Yusuf would change his mind. Shamron seemed to be enjoying the show. When Jacqueline finally agreed to go, he looked up at Gabriel.
"That was marvelous. Nice touch. Well done. Bravo."
5 minutes later, Gabriel watched them climb into the back of a dark blue Vauxhall. A few seconds after the Vauxhall drove away, a car passed beneath Gabriel's window, Shamron's watchers. There was nothing to do now but wait. To fill the time, he rewound the tape and listened to their conversation again.
"Tell me something," Jacqueline had said. "When this is over, will I ever see you again?"
Gabriel stopped the tape and wondered whether she was speaking to Yusuf or to him. The Cromwell Road, midnight. Somewhere in the western suburbs they had switched cars, the blue Vauxhall for a gray Toyota with a cracked windshield. They had switched drivers, too. In place of the boy with the ponytail, there was now an older man, his face narrow, his eyes nervous and black. Yusuf murmured a few words to him in Arabic. Jacqueline said,
"Speak French or English or nothing at all."
"We are Palestinians," Yusuf said. "Arabic is our language."
"I don't give a shit. I don't speak Arabic. I can't understand what you're saying, and it's making me uncomfortable, so please speak fucking English or you can find someone else."
"I was only telling him to slow down a little."
"Actually, Yusuf, you were telling him to make certain we aren't being followed, but let's not get hung up on the details."
On the seat between them lay a small suitcase. Yusuf had taken her to her flat and helped her pack.
"There won't be time to go to baggage claim," he had said. "If you need more clothing, you'll be given money to buy more clothing."
He had watched her pack carefully, inspecting each item she placed in the bag.
"How should I dress?" she had asked sarcastically. "Warm climate or cold? Are we going to Norway or to New Zealand? Sweden or Swaziland? What's the dress code, formal or casual?"
She lit a cigarette. Yusuf took one out too and held out his hand for Jacqueline's lighter. She gave it to him and watched him light his cigarette. He was about to hand it back when something made him stop and inspect the lighter more carefully. Jacqueline felt as if she had forgotten how to breathe.
"This is very nice."
He turned it over and read the inscription.
to Dominique with affection and fond memories. Where did you get this cigarette lighter?
I've had it for about 100 years.
Answer my question.
It was a gift from a man. A man who didn't send me off with a complete stranger.
He must have been very kind, this man. Why have I never seen this?
You haven't seen a lot of things. That doesn't mean anything.
Should I be jealous?
Look at the date, you idiot.
June 1995, he recited. Is this man still in the picture?
If he was, I wouldn't be with you.
When was the last time you saw him?
June 1995, with affection and fond memories.
He must have been very important to you, otherwise he wouldn't have kept his lighter.
It's not his lighter, it's my lighter, and I kept it because it's a good lighter.
She leaned her head against the window.
Where are we going, for God's sake?
Someplace safe, a flat that belongs to a friend of mine, near Heathrow.
Is your friend going to be there?
No.
Are you going to stay the night?
Of course. And in the morning I'll fly with you to Paris.
And after that?
After that you'll be in the company of our Palestinian official and your journey will begin.
Shamron answered the telephone in the listening post before it could ring a second time. He listened without speaking, then gently replaced the receiver.
It looks as though they've settled for the night. It's a council estate in Hounslow near the airport.
And the team?
In place, well hidden. They'll spend the night with her.
I'd feel better if I were there.
You'll have a long day ahead of you tomorrow. I suggest you get a few hours' sleep.
But Gabrielle went into the bedroom and returned a moment later, jacket on, nylon rucksack over his shoulder. Shamron said,
"Where are you going?"
"I need to take care of something personal."
"Where are you going? When will you be back?"
But Gabrielle walked out without another word and followed the stairs down to the street. As he walked past the front of the building, he thought he saw Shamron eyeing him through a slit in the blinds. And as he moved closer to the Edgware Road, he had the uncomfortable feeling that Shamron had one of his teams watching him, too. Hounslow, England. In the dreary, all but empty flat to which Yusuf had taken her, Jacqueline decided to sleep in her clothes. She didn't even want the bedding to touch her, and she smoked a last cigarette to cover up the overpowering smell of disinfectant. She listened to the jetliners overhead. She thought of Gabrielle, her dance school in Valbonne. Then she heard Yusuf on his mobile phone in the other room. She couldn't quite make out what he was saying. She didn't care. Indeed, her last thought before drifting into a fitful sleep was that Yusuf, her Palestinian lover, probably did not have long to live. Isherwood opened the door of his home in Onslow Gardens a few inches and eyed Gabrielle malevolently through the security chain. "Do you have any idea what time it is?" He unchained the door. "Come inside before we both get pneumonia." Isherwood wore pajamas, leather slippers, a silk dressing gown. He led Gabrielle into the drawing room, then disappeared into the kitchen. He returned a moment later with a pot of coffee and a couple of mugs. "I hope you take your coffee black, because I'm afraid the milk in the fridge was purchased during the Thatcher government."
"Black is fine."
"So, Gabrielle, my love, what brings you here at..." He paused to look at his watch and grimaced. "Christ, at 2:45 in the morning."
"You're going to lose Dominique."
"I guessed that when Ari Shamron rolled into my gallery like a poisonous cloud. Where's she off to? Lebanon? Libya? Iran? What was her real name, by the way?"
Gabrielle just sipped his coffee and said nothing.
"Hate to see her go, actually. An angel, that one. And not a bad secretary once she got the hang of things."
"She won't be coming back."
"They never do. I have a way of driving away women. Always have."
I heard you're negotiating a deal with Oliver Dimbleby to sell the gallery.
One doesn't really negotiate when one is tied to the railroad tracks, Gabriel. One grovels. One begs.
Don't do it.
How dare you sit there and tell me how to run my affairs? I wouldn't be in this mess if it weren't for you and your friend Herr Heller.
The operation may be over sooner than we expected, and I can get back to work on the Vecellio.
There's no way you can finish it in time to save my neck. I am now officially insolvent, which is why I'm negotiating with Oliver Dimbleby.
Dimbleby's a hack. He'll ruin the gallery.
Frankly, Gabriel, I'm too tired to give a shit at this point. I need something stronger than coffee. You?
Gabriel shook his head. Isherwood shuffled over to the sideboard and dumped an inch of gin into a tumbler.
What's in the bag?
An insurance policy.
Insurance on what?
Against the possibility that I'm unable to complete work on the Vecellio in time.
Gabriel handed the bag to Isherwood.
Open it.
Isherwood set down his drink and unzipped the bag.
My God, Gabriel, how much is it?
100,000.
I can't take your money.
It's not mine. It's Shamron's, via Benjamin Stone.
The Benjamin Stone?
In all his glory.
What the hell are you doing with £100,000 of Benjamin Stone's money?
Just take it and don't ask any more questions.
If it's really Benjamin Stone's, I think I will.
Isherwood raised his glass of gin.
Cheers, Gabriel. I'm sorry for all the miserable things I've thought about you during the past few weeks.
I deserved it. I should never have run out on you.
All is forgiven.
Isherwood stared into his drink for a long moment.
So where is she? Gone for good?
The operation has moved into its final stages.
You've not put that poor girl in any danger, have you?
I hope not.
So do I, for her sake and yours.
What are you talking about?
You know, I've been in this lousy racket for almost 40 years, and in all that time, no one's ever managed to sell me a forgery. Dimbleby's had his fingers burned. Even the great Giles Pittaway has managed to buy a fake or two in his time. But not me. I have the gift, you see. I may be a lousy businessman, but I can always tell a fraud from the real thing.
Are you coming to the point of this?
She's the real thing, Gabriel. She's golden. You may never get another chance like this. Hang on to her. Because if you don't, it will be the biggest mistake of your life.
Before what the Palestinians call Al-Nakba, the catastrophe of partition, Daoud al-Hurani lived in the Upper Galilee. He was a Mukhtar and the richest man in the village. He owned livestock, several head of cattle, many goats, and a large flock of sheep, as well as a grove of lemon, orange, and olive trees. When it was time to pick the fruit, he and the other village elders organized a communal harvest. The family lived in a whitewashed house with cool tile floors and fine rugs and cushions. His wife bore him 5 daughters, but only one son, Mahmud. Daoud al-Hurani kept up good relations with the Jews, who had settled on land near the village. When the Jews' well became fouled, he drafted men from the village to help them dig a new one. When several Arabs in the village fell sick with malaria, Jews from the settlement came and drained a nearby swamp. Daoud al-Hurani learned to speak Hebrew. When one of his daughters fell in love with a Jewish man from the settlement, he permitted them to marry. Then came the war, and then the catastrophe. The al-Hurani clan, along with most of the Arabs of the Upper Galilee, fled across the border into Lebanon and settled in a refugee camp near Sidon. The camp itself was organized much like the villages of the Upper Galilee, and Daoud al-Hurani retained his status as an elder and a respected man, even though his land had been taken and his animals lost. His large, whitewashed home was replaced by a cramped tent, broiling in the heat of summer, freezing and porous in the cold rains of winter. In the evenings, the men sat outside the tents and told stories of Palestine. Daoud al-Harani assured his people that the exile would only be temporary, that the Arab armies would gather themselves and hurl the Jews into the sea. But the Arab armies didn't gather themselves, and they didn't try to hurl the Jews into the sea. At the camp in Sidon, the tents turned to tattered rags, only to be replaced by crude huts with open sewers. Slowly, as the years passed, Daoud al-Harani began to lose influence over his villagers. He had told them to be patient, but their patience had gone unrewarded. Indeed, the plight of the Palestinians seemed only to worsen. During those first awful years in the camp, there was only one piece of joyous news. Daoud al-Harani's wife became pregnant, even though she had reached the age when most women can no longer bear children. The boy she gave birth to they called Tariq. Tariq's life was all bitterness. Charles de Gaulle Airport, Paris. Yusuf slipped his hand into Jacqueline's and guided her through the crowded terminal to a crowded café. "Go in there," he said. "Order a cup of coffee and read the newspaper that I've slipped into the flap of your bag. The man who's coming for you will be traveling under the name of Lucien Davout. He'll identify himself to you, but if he isn't here within an hour..."
"I know. Get on the next available flight for London and don't try to contact you when I arrive," Jacqueline said, finishing his sentence for him. "I remember everything you've told me."
He kissed her on the cheek.
"You'll have a spy's memory, Dominique."
"Actually, I have my mother's memory."
He smiled and melted into the crowd. It was a small airport restaurant, a few wrought-iron tables spilling into the terminal to create the illusion of a Parisian café. Jacqueline sat down and ordered a café au lait from the waiter. She was suddenly conscious of her appearance and felt an absurd desire to make a good first impression. She wore black jeans and an ash-colored cashmere pullover. Her face had no makeup, and she had done nothing with her hair except pull it back. When the waiter brought her coffee, Jacqueline lifted the spoon and looked at the distorted reflection of her eyes. They were red-rimmed and raw from a miserable previous night. She took a sip of her coffee. She glanced at the newspaper headlines. U.S. President applauds interim agreement reached between Israel and the Palestinians. Signing ceremony next week at United Nations. An attractive woman with lustrous black hair and wide brown eyes approached her and asked if she could sit down.
"Actually, I'm meeting someone," Jacqueline answered. "You're meeting Lucien Davout. I'm Lucien's friend."
She pulled out the chair and sat down.
"Lucien asked me to collect you and take you to your flight." "I was told that Lucien himself would meet me here." "I understand, but I'm afraid there's been a slight change in plan."
Jacqueline had no idea what to do. They had violated the terms of the agreement. She had every right to stand up and walk off and be done with it.
But then what?
Tariq would slip away and continue his campaign of terror. More innocent Jews would die. The peace process would be placed in jeopardy. And Gabriel would go on blaming himself for what had happened to Leah and his son in Vienna.
"I don't like this, but I'll do it." "Good, because they've just called our flight."
Jacqueline stood up, picked up her bag, and followed the woman out of the café.
"Our flight?" she asked. "That's right. I'm going to be traveling with you for the first leg of your journey. Lucien will join you later." "Where are we going?" "You'll find out in a moment." "Since we are going to be traveling together, do you think you could tell me your name?"
The girl smiled again.
"If you feel you must call me something, you may call me Leila."
Gabrielle stood in a duty-free shop 100 feet away, pretending to look at cologne, while he watched Jacqueline at the café. Shamron was aboard Benjamin Stone's private plane. All they needed was Tariq. Suddenly, he realized that he was excited by the prospect of finally seeing Tariq. The photographs in Shamron's file were useless, too old, too grainy. Three of them were only presumed to be pictures of Tariq. The truth was, no one inside the office really knew what he looked like. Gabriel was about to get the first good look at him in years. Was he tall or short? Was he handsome or ordinary-looking? Did he look like a ruthless killer? Of course not, Gabriel thought. He'll be someone who blends naturally into his surroundings. He'll be like me. Then he thought, or am I like him? When the attractive, raven-haired girl sat down at Jacqueline's table, he thought for a moment that it was just one of those horrid accidents that sometimes sends operations into a tailspin. Girl needs a seat, girl assumes Jacqueline's alone, girl helps herself to the empty chair. Then he realized it was part of Tariq's game. He had survived all these years because he was unpredictable. He made plans and changed plans constantly. Told different stories to different members of his organization. Never let the left hand know what the right was doing. The two women stood up and started walking. Gabriel waited for a moment, then trailed them from a safe distance. He felt dejected. The game had barely begun, and already Tariq had bested him. He wondered whether he was really ready to do battle with a man like Tariq. He had been out of the game too long. Perhaps his reactions had slowed, his instincts for survival waned. He thought of the night he'd planted the bugs in Yusuf's flat, how he had nearly been caught because he had lost his concentration for a few seconds. He felt the sickening rush of adrenaline all over again. For a moment he considered rushing forward and pulling her out. He forced himself to calm down and think clearly. She was just getting on an airplane. She would be safe while they were in the air, and Shamron would have a team waiting at the other end. Tariq had won the first round, but Gabriel decided to let the game continue. The girl led Jacqueline into a glass-enclosed gate area. They were headed for Air France 382. Their destination was Montreal. A few moments after takeoff, Shamron hung up the secure telephone in the office of Benjamin Stone's private jet and joined Gabrielle in the luxuriously appointed salon.
I just notified Ottawa Station.
Who's in Ottawa these days?
Your old friend, Zvi Yadin. He's on his way to Montreal now with a small team. They'll meet the plane and put Jacqueline and her new friend under watch.
Why Montreal?
Haven't you read the papers?
I'm sorry, Ari, but I've been a bit busy.
On the table next to Shamron's chair was a stack of newspapers, neatly arranged so the mastheads were visible. He snatched the top paper and flipped it into Gabrielle's lap.
There's going to be a signing ceremony at the UN in 3 days. Everyone's going to be there. The American president, the prime minister, Arafat, and all his deputies. It looks as though Tariq's going to try to spoil the party.
Gabriel glanced at the newspaper and tossed it back onto the table.
For Tariq, Montreal is a natural staging point. He speaks fluent French, so he flies to Montreal as a Frenchman and enters Quebec without a visa. Then he drives, or for that matter, he walks across the border into Vermont or New York. Security along that border is practically non-existent. As for the way he shook things up at the airport just now, well, that's the way he's kept alive all these years.
The door connecting the salon to the office opened, and Stone entered the room. Shamron said,
"There's a stateroom in the back of the plane. Go get some sleep. You look terrible."
Gabriel stood up without a word and left the salon. Stone lowered his mammoth body into a chair and scooped up a handful of Brazil nuts.
"He has passion," he said, popping a pair of nuts into his mouth. "An assassin with a conscience. I like that. The rest of the world is going to like him even better." "Benjamin, what on earth are you talking about?"
"He's the meal ticket. Don't you understand, Ari? When this is over, we tell the story of Gabriel and this whole marvelous manhunt in my newspapers.
What a signal to my financial backers in the city. What a lovely proof that I'm still a force to be reckoned with. Don't you see, Ari? This is the way you repay your debts to me.
Shamron made an elaborate show of lighting a cigarette. He studied Stone through a cloud of smoke, nodding slowly while he considered the gravity of his proposition. Stone was a drowning man, and unless Shamron did something to cut him away, he would take them both straight to the bottom. Gabriel tried to sleep, but it was no use. Each time he closed his eyes, images of the case appeared in his mind. Instinctively, he saw them rendered as motionless reproductions captured in oil on canvas. Shamron in Cornwall calling him back to service. Jacqueline making love to Yusuf. Leah in her greenhouse prison in Surrey. Yusuf meeting his contact in Hyde Park.
"Don't worry, Yusuf. Your girlfriend won't say no to you."
Then he thought of the scene he had just witnessed at Charles de Gaulle. Restoring old paintings had taught Gabriel a valuable lesson. Sometimes what appears on the surface is quite different from what is taking place just below. Paris. For 2 hours, Yusuf moved about by metro, by taxi, and on foot. Then, when he was confident he was alone, he walked to an apartment house near the Bois de Boulogne and pressed the button for 4B, Guzman. When the door opened, he stepped quickly inside, crossed the foyer, and rode the lift up to the fourth floor. There another door opened. A man with steel blue eyes and strawberry blonde hair, looking perhaps too pleased with himself, quickly pulled Yusuf inside. It was early evening in Tel Aviv when Mordecai stepped out of his office in the top-floor executive suite and made his way down the corridor toward operations. As he entered the room, a pair of Lev's black-eyed desk officers stared at him contemptuously over their computer terminals.
"Is he still in?"
One of the officers pointed toward Lev's office with the tip of a chewed pencil. Mordecai turned and walked down the corridor. He felt like a stranger in a besieged village. Outsiders were not welcome in Lev's realm, even if the outsider happened to be the second most senior officer in the service. He found Lev in his cheerless office, hunched forward over several different maps. Mordecai thought that, with his bald head, protruding eyes, and tentacle-like fingers, he looked very much like a praying mantis.
"Something in Canada I should know about?" Mordecai asked.
"What are you talking about?"
"I was reviewing the expense reports from Ottawa Station. I tried to reach Zvi on the phone."
"What does this have to do with operations?" Lev interrupted.
"I couldn't find Zvi. In fact, I couldn't find anyone. It seems your entire Ottawa Station is missing."
"What do you mean, missing?"
"I mean nowhere to be found, gone without explanation."
"Well, where's the old man, Shamron?"
"Somewhere in Europe, I think. You think he tells me anything?"
"Well, let's find him," Lev said.
Montreal. Layla rented a car at the airport and drove fast along an elevated motorway. To their right lay an icy river. To their left, freezing fog drifted over a vast rail yard like the smoke of battle. The lights of downtown Montreal floated in front of them, obscured by a veil of low cloud and falling snow. Layla drove as if she knew the way.
"You've been here before?" Layla asked.
It was the first time she had spoken to Jacqueline since the café at Charles de Gaulle in Paris.
"No, never. How about you?"
"No."
Jacqueline folded her arms against her body and shivered. The heater was roaring, but it was still so cold in the car she could see her breath.
"I don't have clothes for this kind of cold," she said.
"Lucien will buy you whatever you need."
So, Lucien was meeting her here in Montreal. Jacqueline blew on her hands.
"It's too cold to go shopping.
All the best boutiques in Montreal are underground. You'll never have to set foot outside."
I thought you said you'd never been here.
I haven't.
Jacqueline leaned her head against the window and briefly closed her eyes. They had sat in business class, Layla across the aisle and one row behind. An hour before landing, Layla had gone to the lavatory. On the way back to her seat, she'd handed Jacqueline a note.
Go through immigration and customs alone and meet me at the Hertz counter.
Layla turned off the motorway and turned onto the Boulevard René Lévesque. The next thing Jacqueline knew, a hotel porter was opening the car door for her.
Welcome to the Queen Elizabeth, he said. Checking in?
Tariq, in charcoal-gray trousers, a cream-colored pullover, and an Italian blazer, watched them from the hotel bar. He had seen the photograph of the woman called Dominique Bonnard, but he was still taken aback by her appearance. He wondered how Shamron and Gabriel Allon could justify putting a woman like that into such danger. He glanced around the lobby. He knew that they were here, somewhere, hidden among the tourists and the businessmen and the hotel employees, Shamron's watchers. Tariq had stretched their resources by taking the woman from London to Paris and then Montreal. But surely they had regrouped and moved their assets into place. He knew that the moment he approached the woman, he would be revealing himself to his enemies for the first time. He found that he was actually looking forward to it. Finally, after all these years in the shadows, he was about to step into the light. He wanted to shout,
"Here I am. See, I'm a man like you, flesh and blood, not a monster."
He was not ashamed of his life's work. Quite the opposite. He was proud of it. He wondered if Alon could say the same thing. Tariq knew that he had one major advantage over Alon. He knew he was about to die. His life was over. He had survived on the knife edge of danger to be betrayed in the end not by his enemies, but by his own body. He would use the knowledge of his impending death like a weapon, the most powerful he had ever possessed. Tariq stood up, smoothed the front of his blazer, and crossed the lobby. They rode an elevator to the 14th floor, walked along a quiet corridor, stopped at room 1417. He opened the door with an electronic card key, then slipped the card into his pocket. When Jacqueline entered the room, Shamron's awareness and memory drills took over. Small suite, separate bedroom and sitting room. On the coffee table was a room service tray with a half-eaten salad. A garment bag lay on the floor, open, still packed. He held out his hand. He smiled warmly.
"I was told by my associates that you were a very beautiful woman, but I'm afraid their descriptions did not do you justice."
His mannerisms and speech were all very French. If she had not known he was a Palestinian, she would have assumed he was a well-to-do Parisian.
"You're not what I expected," she said truthfully.
"Oh, really? What did you expect?"
He was already testing her. She could sense it.
"Yusuf said you were an intellectual. I suppose I was expecting someone with long hair and blue jeans and a sweater with holes in it."
"Someone more professorial."
"Yes, that's the word." She managed to smile. "You don't look terribly professorial."
"That's because I'm not a professor."
"I'd ask what you are, but Yusuf told me not to ask too many questions, so I suppose we'll just have to make pleasant small talk. Do you mind if I smoke?"
"Not at all."
She placed a cigarette between her lips and struck the lighter Shamron had given her. She could almost imagine the radio waves flying out, searching for a receiver.
"I also need to check my machine in London."
"Of course," he said.
He reached out and pressed the speaker button on the telephone.
"Tell me the number and I'll dial it for you."
She recited the number and his fingers worked over the keypad. A few seconds later she heard the phone ringing, the two-beat moan of a British phone, followed by the sound of her own voice on the message tape. She pictured a technician, seated behind a computer console in Tel Aviv, reading the words, "Hotel Queen Elizabeth, Montreal, room 1417. She reached out for the receiver, but he covered it with his hand and looked up at her.
"I'd like to listen, if you don't mind. It's my paranoia, I'm afraid."
She had three messages. The first was from a woman who identified herself as Dominique's mother. The second was from Julian Isherwood. He had misplaced a file and was wondering if she could give him a ring at some point to help him locate it. The third was from a man who didn't identify himself. She instantly recognized the sound of Gabrielle's voice.
"I just wanted you to know that I was thinking of you. If you need anything, I'm here for you. See you soon, I hope. Cheers."
"That didn't sound much like Youssef," Tariq said when he had severed the connection.
"It wasn't Youssef. It was a man I knew before Youssef."
"It sounds to me as though this man still cares for you."
"No, he never really cared for me."
"But it's obvious to me you cared for him. Perhaps you still do."
"I'm in love with Youssef."
"Ah, yes, I forgot."
He stood abruptly.
"Come, let me take you shopping. You weren't prepared for the weather here."
Montreal. Zvi Yadin met Gabrielle and Shamron at the airport and drove them into Montreal. He had thick, curly hair, a rather shaggy, full beard, and the body of a rugby player. Gabrielle had spent time at the academy with him. They had been paired for the physical combat course, despite the vast difference in their size, and on the final day, Yadin had broken two of Gabrielle's ribs.
"They say it's going to be 30 below tonight," Yadin said as he sped along the motorway toward downtown. "I brought you some parkas and gloves. And I brought this for you, Gabrielle."
He handed Gabrielle a stainless steel combat case. Inside was a .22 Beretta target pistol. Gabrielle stroked the barrel and the walnut grip. The gun felt cold. He closed the lid and placed the case beneath the seat.
Shamron said, "Thanks for the weather updates, V, but where the hell is Jacqueline?"
Yadin brought them quickly up to date. He had two men and one woman in the public areas of the hotel. He had a third man in a guest room to monitor the glass they had on the phone in 1417. Getting the glass there had been the work of a Sayan Zvi had on the hotel staff, a senior concierge. By the way, the girl who had accompanied Jacqueline from Paris was gone. She'd been picked up by another car outside the hotel, and Zvi hadn't tried to follow her. He hadn't thought he could spare the personnel. The man had signed in under the name of Lucien Davo.
"Was it Tariq?" Shamron asked.
"Could be. It's hard to say."
Zvi cleared his throat.
"There's a problem, boss. While I was waiting for you to arrive, I checked in with the station. Seems Mordecai called on a routine housekeeping matter. Obviously, he told Lev the entire station was missing, because now there's a cable from Lev asking what the fuck is going on."
"So tell him some bullshit," Shamron said.
At that, Yadin's cell phone chirped softly.
"Yes?"
A pause.
"When?"
Another pause.
"Where?" "We'll stay with them. But remember who you're dealing with. Keep a safe distance."
He glanced toward Shamron.
"Looks like they're going shopping."
In one of the shops beneath the Rue Sainte-Catherine, Jacqueline picked out a full-length down-lined coat and a fur hat. In another, she selected two pairs of jeans and several pairs of long underwear. Her escort paid for everything with a credit card in the name of Lucien Davo. But he was also constantly checking to see if they were being followed. Jacqueline knew that from the abrupt changes in direction, the contrived excuses for doubling back.
"What are you waiting for? Do it now," Jacqueline thought. "Take him down now."
But no, they couldn't do it here, not in underground Montreal. The entire network of shopping malls could be sealed off in a matter of minutes. Gabrielle and the rest of the team would be trapped inside. They would be arrested, questioned. The police would establish a link to the office, and the whole thing would blow up in Shamron's face. For their command post, Yadin had taken a suite at the Sheraton, a few blocks up from the Queen Elizabeth. When Tariq and Jacqueline returned to their quarters, it was to the Sheraton that Yadin took Shamron and Gabriel to huddle. A black-haired girl named Deborah accompanied them. She had been shadowing Jacqueline and Tariq around the stores in underground Montreal. Jacqueline, she thought, was holding up pretty well. She also thought that Tariq seemed to be carrying a gun. The phone rang. The man monitoring in the guest room at the Queen Elizabeth was calling to